Hi, I'm Robert Osborne, and welcome to another edition of TCM's Private Screenings Uncut. Chance for those who love movies to hear the complete interview, start to finish, that I've done for TCM's Private Screening series with some of Hollywood's most celebrated actors. The big plus here being that you can now hear a great deal of material which never made it into the final version that originally aired on TCM. This month's installment focuses on Academy Award winner Charlton Heston, man whose acting career has unfortunately and I think unfairly been overshadowed and somewhat dismissed because of some of his outspoken political beliefs, primarily those late in his life. But if you put politics aside and really look at the body of Charlton Heston's work, you'll see that he really was very special, a solid actor, very dedicated to his work, and certainly one of the most popular actors of his generation. Well, I sat down with him for an interview in late 1997, which was several years before he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. Heston seemed very healthy and sharp and had an amazing recall of his life, talking about his life with great gusto and flair. In this first half of our talk, Chuck, as he always asks people to call him, talks about the early part of his life, about growing up in rural Michigan, so far from a movie theater that he didn't even know what acting was, let alone that it was a career choice one could make. Well, once the acting bug did bite him, he was infected for life, and his love of the craft of acting really shows in the interview, I think. He talks about his early days on the stage, about learning how to work in front of a camera for live television, and how he became a film actor. He also talks about the events that led him to meeting and impressing director Cecil B. DeMille, the man who cast him in two of his most important films, The Greatest Show on Earth, and in the film in which Heston played Moses, The Ten Commandments. We talk about what it takes for a 28-year-old, like he was at the time, to play a role as imposing as Moses, and what it also took to take on another imposing role, the one for director William Wyler, which earned Heston his Oscar, Ben-Hur. And we hear Chuck's thoughts on Wyler and another man who directed him, Orson Welles. You'll also hear Heston give some play-by-play commentaries on specific scenes from some of his films as he watches them with me. So have a listen. Here, originally recorded in late 1997, the complete audio portion of an interview, which in an abbreviated form, first aired on TCM in February of 1998. Part one of TCM's Private Screenings Uncut, Charlton Heston. Charlton Heston, we're really pleased to have you here. Thanks for being here.
Well, I'm pleased to be here. Please also call me Chuck.
Chuck, I will indeed.
Just not Charlie. Only my wife gets to call me Charlie.
Okay. Well, you have had certainly one of the great film careers, over 50 movies and...
Over 70.
70?
Yeah.
Incredible. And we think of you as having had quite a remarkable career, but what do you think of your career?
Well, art is imperfectible. The Beethoven Fifth is not a flawless symphony. Even King Lear is not a perfect play, and no performer ever gave a perfect performance. But the wonderful thing is you get to keep trying. And I'm determined to keep trying till I get it absolutely right one time.
One of the remarkable things about your career, I think, is the fact that you've had such a long career, the public's loved you so much, and yet you've never been in the tabloids, you've never been, you know, arrested on drug busts and all of that. You haven't had a flamboyant private life that people have read about, yet people are fascinated by you. Why do you think that
well,
is?
Well, I think I've had the good fortune to have played some extraordinary men. At least a dozen or 15 of them genuine historical figures. And the shadow of those guys kind of rubs off a little bit and has lent me a kind of iconic identity which I don't deserve. I do try to do my best in each part, and I have indeed covered a wide variety of parts. I've played certainly more non-American roles than any American actor, and more Shakespearean roles. And men like Richelieu and Michelangelo and Mark Antony and Jefferson and Jackson and Brigham Young and Genghis Khan are interesting guys, and they have done remarkable things. Among them, they have moved the world. And this, as I said, I think tends to rub off a bit.
Well, your popularity is also worldwide.
Because of that, I've played so many Michelangelo for the Italians, El Cid for the Hispanic world, and Scots, Irishmen, Frenchmen. I think that has given me an international identity. And somehow I'm an American actor that is accepted by the Italians as Michelangelo, by Jews as Moses and John the Baptist, and all those things count, I think.
Let's go back to the beginning. You were born in Illinois.
Yes, and raised in Michigan.
Did you have a happy childhood?
I had a perhaps rather lonely childhood because I was raised in a small town in Hamlet, a small hamlet in northern Michigan, where there probably weren't 20 families, all in widely separated houses in the forest. And it was the Depression, and it wasn't a prosperous time for anybody, but for a kid. I went to a one-room school with 13 pupils in 8 grades, 3 of whom were my cousins and half of whom were girls, so there was no possibility of sports. You couldn't make up sides. But there was hunting and fishing and canoeing and reading, and the chance which I seized, since I spent a lot of time by myself wandering around in the woods, acting out the stories I'd read, from Ernest Thompson Seton's Lives of the Hunted to Treasure Island to The Black Arrow and Tom Sawyer and all those things.
So was that where the acting bug first bit?
I didn't know there was acting. It was something I'd never heard of. We occasionally got to go to a movie. There was a movie house about 20 miles away. I didn't think of acting until I had the great good fortune my family moved to a suburb of Chicago, where, because that's where the school was located, I had the great good fortune to attend what was then the best public high school in the United States. And I wasn't equipped for any of the team activities. I'd never held a ball in my hand. And I was besides short and skinny still at that time. The only extracurricular activities for which I qualified was the rifle team and the chess club, and that doesn't make for a sterling career in high school. Then I discovered the theater department.
And remember your first play?
I do indeed. It was a play called Wappan Wharf about pirates, and I played a one-eyed pirate named Patch Eye.
And were you hooked from then on?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Then I won a scholarship. I did Macbeth when I was 14. Must have been dreadful, but at least I got a first chance at the part, which I've done 5 times since. And I won a scholarship to Northwestern, where I met my wife in their theater department, and my life began. And the war interrupted that for 2 years, but I survived the war and came home, and here I sit.
Well, I have to go back just a little. At the age of 16, you also made your first film, a non-professional film, didn't you?
That's true, yes. The only film to this day ever made of Ibsen's Peer Gynt. And I'm undoubtedly the only actor who ever played Peer Gynt unaware of the fact that it's a satiric role, which may be the way to play it. But David Bradley was, nowadays you walk outside and hit any bush and 2 independent filmmakers will run out. But in those days, David must have been one of at most a dozen in the whole country. And he was very resourceful, very gifted.
Was he a young kid as well?
He was older than I was. I think he was 2 or 3 years older. But he was essentially a kid. And I made Peer Gynt for him. Then later on, after I came back from the war, I even did Mark Antony in a film he did of Julius Caesar. That I got paid for. I got $50 a week.
So now you're a pro.
Yes. Well, I was already a pro. I said, David, I've done a play on Broadway. I'm not going to work for nothing.
Did you have an exciting time in the war? Was that a big...
Relatively quiet war. I was in B-25s in the Aleutians, but the weather was so lousy and our mission was really not achievable. You can't use medium bombers to reach the Cure Isles. But had the war not ended with the atom bomb, we were scheduled to transfer to Okinawa and cover the landing on the main islands. That would not have been a quiet war. Along with every man who served in the Pacific, or I believe who served in the war, the atom bomb was a blessing.
So after the war, then you and Lydia were married?
We were married before.
But then you and Lydia went to New York City,
we
both as actors.
Indeed. And she got work before I did. Both modeling, we both did some modeling. I was, in fact, a nude model in the Art Students League, for which I got $1.80 an hour.
That's Do we not have bad. Any of those
photographs or
they weren't photographs, they were drawings. I don't know, there must be in some artist's studios.
They'll be showing up in the tabloids.
Yeah. And then I got my first Broadway job was in very remote support of Catherine Cornell and in Antony and Cleopatra, which ran 7 months, the longest run that play's ever had in this country.
What was life like for an actor in New York in those days? This is the 40s after the war.
Well, we were broke most of the time, or nearly broke, but we had a great time because all our friends were broke too. And you could spend your evenings window shopping in New York safely then. I wouldn't want to be broke in New York now, but we had a great time. And we both got work, and then, of course, I was one of that lucky generation, incredibly lucky. Greatest change in acting since sound came to movies, when that's live television. And the movie people, Kirk and Bert and Paul Newman and all those guys were already under contract and couldn't do it. But about a dozen actors and three or four actresses and four or five directors and a couple of writers got to invent live television because the networks had the technology but didn't have a clue as to how to put on plays. And it was Hal Wallace hired me sight unseen off seeing me play Jane Eyre on television. That's how important it was.
Before he hired you, what was your goal? What was your, as an actor, what were you aiming for then?
Just
was it a career in film?
No, no. In those days, we sort of looked disdained film.
And in those days, you could make a career in the theater, right?
Well, of course, you still can.
Yes.
Well, no, you'd probably be very tough now. But that was the ideal situation then. But then live television was kind of a transition because you were working with a camera. You had to understand lighting, fitting your lighting and hitting your marks and all that stuff. But at the same time, it was like the stage in that you had to do it all in one night. You didn't get to do retakes.
Right.
So when we went into, those of us, Jimmy Dean and Walter Matthau, who went into movies from television, we already not only understood some of the techniques, but we had something of an audience mm-hmm. already. People would see us in a movie and say, oh, I saw that kid on Studio One. What was that thing on television he did? And so we brought something of a reputation to it.
Now, you had these great looks and this size and this talent. You must have had a lot of studios come after you. How did you pick Hal Wallace to go with?
Because all the others wanted a full-term contract, and I insisted.
Meaning, like 7 years?
Yeah,
like that kind of
everybody was under contract, writers, directors, actors, producers, and I didn't want that. I wanted the chance to do work for the directors and I wanted to work for, and to do play television and theater at my own option. And Hal Wallace, not because he thought I was the greatest thing since sliced bread, but he realized that there was no point in developing, as he had just finished doing, guys like Kirk and Bert, or at Warner's, Paul, because he knew what the rest of the people in town didn't know, that the studio system was going to be over. In 5 years, everybody would be independent, which proved to be the case. But that's why he gave me a five-picture contract and sold two of the commitments to Mr. DeMille, and for the rest of the time, I could do what I wanted.
And he starred you in your first film, first film.
Oh, yes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So was that live training on television then really paid off for you?
I think so, yeah. I knew more than I would have known if I had gone straight from the stage because of television.
Do you remember your reaction to seeing you on film for the first time? I mean, were you pleased with the look?
No, I'd seen myself on television, kinescopes. So that did not surprise me, you know. And you always, when you look at cut film dailies or indeed a finished film, what you look for or should look for is what you could have done better, mm-hmm. which is just about everything. I'd love if I had the gift from God to do it all over again, that would be my choice because exactly the same parts and I could do them better.
Now, when you went to Hollywood in the 50s, it was, of course, television was coming into the picture and
but
Hollywood
the movies
was,
thought it was going to go away.
So there wasn't that feeling around town that there was, that the Hollywood as people had known it was kind of on its way out? You didn't feel
well,
that?
Well, of course, I was not privy to the inner councils of the studio heads, but they at first they said, this is going to be like the hula hoop. It's not going to last. Don't worry about it. Of course, they were wrong. They could have, it has to be the stupidest decision they ever made, because they could have owned television, because the networks had only the technology. They had no idea about how to make stories.
So your second film then was for Cecil B. DeMille,
yes.
A film that won the Oscar as the best one of the year.
What
a break. How did that come about?
Serendipity. I believe in serendipity, which, as you know, is the unexpected good consequences of an entirely random act, which in my case was waving at Mr. DeMille as I drove off the lot, having met him. And
you were just driving, and why did you wave?
Well, because I'd been introduced to him, and he was standing on the steps of his building talking to his people. And I was in a convertible with the top down, so you could wave. You know, you can't put your arm out of a window and wave. You could wave like that. And I did, and he said, who is that? And his secretary, who did not take down everything he said, but just about, she leafed through a book, and she said, that's Charlton Heston. Hal Wallace signed him from Broadway. He'd just done one film, Dark City. You ran it 10 days ago. You didn't like it. He said, I like the way he waved just now, though. And presto, I played the lead in my second picture, in which won the Academy Award, and again, here we sit.
Incredible. What was DeMille like? We hear so many stories about him, but as a director, for an actor, what was he like?
Well, the first thing you have to remember is that he was one of the guys that invented the movies, along with Adolf Zukor and Samuel Goldwyn. He made the first film made in Hollywood. If it hadn't been raining when he stopped on his way out, he was going to shoot in Flagstaff. And it was raining, and he said, this is ridiculous. Get on the train. We'll go out to Los Angeles. Otherwise, I would be living in Flagstaff right now. But he was not a shouter. He never shouted. Very demanding director, which most good directors are. So was Wells. So was Wyler. So was Stevens. So was Lean. But he knew what he wanted. He was the Spielberg of his time, or perhaps it would be more accurate to say that Spielberg is the DeMille of his time. In what they shared in common was an incredible, almost mystic ability to know absolutely not what the audience wanted to see this month, but what they would want to see in 10 months, in the course of which you can make a movie. And they both have profited from that magic ability, and he was I remember when he rebuked, he could rebuke people very sternly. And when he rebuked some assistant directors, and I talked to his still man who had been with him since the silent days, and I said, he's a pretty tough old bird, isn't he? And he said, oh, he's not so tough. He said, he just expects a good day's work, a very good day's work. But as I've said, I made three pictures for him. And I've always said, if you can't make a career out of three DeMille pictures, you're in the wrong business.
Do you think he's fairly judged today? He was such a king of Hollywood at that time.
Oh, yes.
Time.
He was like Spielberg. Mm-hmm. He could do whatever he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his credits as having invented the movies are credit enough. But I think some of his films, like Ten Commandments and The Greatest Show, will persist. Along with many others, the films he made with Duke Wayne and Gary Cooper, The Plainsman, and so on.
Now, the movie has a very famous train wreck in it.
Ah, yes.
That had an effect on you, or you had an effect on it, the shooting of it.
Oh,
tell
you
us
mean
a little
with
about
the
that.
Elephant?
Mm.
Well, in the wreck, I'm supposed to be trapped under the wreckage, lying pinned down by a piece of the wreckage, and they bring in an elephant who can easily lift the bit off. And that was, the elephants was well trained and well able to do that. And Gloria Graham leads in the elephant. And he stepped on a spike and went, of course, back in his hind legs, trumpeting, stamping. And everybody else ran, but I was still under the timber and couldn't run. And I tried to look dead, probably succeeded. And then everything quieted down, and the elephant lifted it off perfectly easily.
It was very well known at the time about the fact that DeMille took a lot of you out on the road with the actual circus when they filmed that.
Oh, we
that
filmed
movie.
A great deal of it on location at the winter quarters in Sarasota, And then when the circus was actually touring, we went to three or four cities. I remember Philadelphia and Washington, a couple of others.
So you actually lived with the circus people?
Oh, it was very valuable for me and for all of us, I'm sure. Jimmy Stewart designed his clown makeup after he'd spent some time on the road with the circus in winter quarters. And it was also very exciting. I think every kid has a brief period when he wants to run away with the circus. And we got to do that.
Also, one of the great things about the picture, I think, is it's a great documentary of the circus in the days when it was a tent. Now it plays in auditoriums, and you really had a sense of what it was like in those days when
the circus
indeed. Came to town.
DeMille, among making a wonderful picture, documented the end of the circus under canvas. That was the last season they worked under canvas, really. And it was marvelous to see them put the whole thing up when you got to a new city, and the whole business of loading the trains and getting the animals on and all the equipment. It was a vast technological undertaking to move the circus. A lot harder than moving an NFL team to a new site. And also, it was wonderful to be with them. They were very interesting people, very, very clannish. They lived as a separate community, but they were very friendly and wonderful with me. And I enjoyed it enormously and learned a great deal. Among other things, I got out of that picture, of course, the fact that in my second picture it won the Academy Award as Best Film was not bad, and a great step up in my career. And then I also got the best notice I've ever gotten in my life. After the film came out and won the Academy Award and everything, DeMille called me into his office, and he wasn't talking about Ten Commandments then. But we chatted a while, and he said, "You know, Chuck," he said, "you've had some very nice notices in this film." He said, "I know you'll have many more on stage and screen, but," he said, "I have in my hand what is undoubtedly the best notice you'll ever get." And I thought, who wrote this? This New York Times, what? And he said, "It's a letter somebody wrote me." And he read the letter. It was from a man who had enjoyed the circus and said, "No one has ever caught what the feeling of a circus the way you did in your film. Jimmy Stewart was marvelous as the clown. Betty Hutton has never been better. Cornell Wilde was fine." And he said, "And I thought that circus manager did very well in there with the real actors."
Oh,
you can't get a better notice than
indeed.
They think you're not an actor.
Indeed. So that kind of solidified you with DeMille, though, or at least introduced your talents to DeMille, and then came 4 years
later.
Then
came, of course, Ten Commandments. Now, DeMille says in his autobiography, though I never discussed it with him, of course, that he never had any doubt in his mind over who was to play Moses. I can't believe, really, that he didn't at least consider a number of other actors that would be obvious choices, would be in the running. And when DeMille was considering casting, he would have actors in to talk about it. But he never mentioned what part, he never let anybody read a script. And he never would discuss with you what part he might be considering you for. That was true of The Greatest Show on Earth, too. And he would tell the story of the film more or less from the standpoint of the character he was thinking that he might have you play, but he would never say that. He would just tell him and show you the drawings and the paintings and the props that were beginning to be made and all those things, set designs, model sets, all that he would show you, and you'd maybe be in there an hour and a half. But you never could say, "Gee, I think I could really do that part, Mr. DeMille," because he had not said that he was thinking you might do it. So about all you could say was, "Boy, that certainly sounds like that's going to be a wonderful picture." And
sure,
then
plan to see that movie.
Yeah, I'd like to see that one made.
How does one study to play Moses? How do you prepare to play Moses at the age of 28?
Do all the reading you can, that was not my first historical role, so I'd already understood the importance of that. And there is a huge number of books about Moses, including one by Sigmund Freud called Moses and Monotheism. And of course, I quickly realized that the best research was the five books of Moses that make up the opening books of the Old Testament. And in the King James Version, which is I promise you, the only version. It's close to Shakespeare. It's exactly the same kind of writing. I often thought that Bastard Son of Shakespeare might have been one of the junior clerks filling the inkwells and sharpening the quill pens when they were writing the King James Bible. And that gave me more understanding about the part than any of the subsidiary reading I did, Breasted's History of Egypt, all that stuff. But it was a very difficult part. I was a little green for it, in all honesty. I certainly could do it better now, but I apparently squeaked through on the performance. But I think one of the reasons it turned out so well was that Mr. DeMille, we began with the location work in Egypt, where we shot for 2 months or more. But the very first shot I did was not in the proper sequence of the script. It was a shot of Moses coming barefoot down Mount Sinai after hearing the voice of God speak to him from the fire. And it was I that suggested that it would be good to do it barefoot, because I said, you know, Mr. DeMille, if God has just told Moses, take off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. And then he tells them to go lead the Jews out of bondage. I don't think he'd stop to put his shoes on. And he said, that's a good idea. And so he
was open to ideas as well.
Oh, yes, indeed. He even kept a special minting of a silver half dollar that had been minted some years before, honoring Virginia Dare, the first white child born in America. And he bought the whole issue and used them as medals if you made some suggestion, whether it was an extra or a makeup man or a cameraman or whoever, an actor.
Wasn't it your idea too to be the voice of God?
Yes. That was under some debate. He said, you know, you've got a pretty good part already, Chuck. And I said, but surely Moses hears the voice of God from inside him, and therefore it seems to me I could do that. And there was a lot of back and forth about it, but to which I was not privy, but in the end I did.
Do you have a favorite moment yourself in the movie when you see the film?
Oh, goodness. I guess the burning bush is pretty good. Good scene. Parting the Red Sea is, but that's, I don't have a lot to do with that. you need
the stick. Spectacular moment.
It's a wonderful shot.
Always good to have a big stick.
You need the stick.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Chuck, let's have a look at the famous Exodus scene in Ten Commandments for a moment.
Yeah. That's one of the great such scenes in the world. There are scenes like that. That's one of the things about making movies, where you don't have to act. When I'm doing that moment there, I'm facing that group. And you don't have to act Moses. You become Moses because of there were 5,000, 8,000 people in that shot. And it was irresistibly moving. It was moving. When I said, bear us out of Egypt, O Lord, as an eagle bears its young upon its wings, you don't have to act that. And you see it throughout. There's a wonderful story about that. It's the only joke about DeMille I've ever heard him laugh at. He thought it was very funny. It's apocryphal, it's not true, but it's a great story. This scene, you see that mass of people, and it took all day to shoot. We got three takes, because it took that long to get the people turned around and moved back. And after the third take, as the story has it, Mr. DeMille had three cameras going at different locations. And after the third take, DeMille is supposed to have said to the cameraman under one of the sphinxes, he said, how did that go? How was that? He said, it was fine, Mr. DeMille, but we only got about 40 seconds of film. Then one of those camels fell down right in front of the lens, and we couldn't get him out. We couldn't get him to stand up, and no way to get out there. And so we've got 30, 40 seconds. That's all. He says, That's too bad. Well, he said, how was your close-up angle, Fred, with the second camera? And he said, Mr. DeMille, my focus puller screwed up. He said, it's out of focus the whole way through. I don't have a foot of film. DeMille controlled himself, and he then picked up the loudspeaker and shouted to the guy with the long lens, way up in a ridge, maybe 300 yards away. He says, how about for you, Doug? The guy said, anytime you're ready, CB. Not true, but it's a
Not
funny
true.
Story. It's the only movie story I've ever heard that is entered into the general language.
Uh-huh. Indeed.
It's used all the time.
I think there's a play called Ready When You Are,
I think you're right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Ten Commandments really made you the actor for epic roles. And you once said, my face seems to belong to any century but my own. Did that help, the face?
I think that probably, oh, well, of course it did. It's an employer, the broken nose and the height and the
base. How did the nose get broken?
In football in high school, which I played very badly, but I'm very grateful to the guy that broke my nose. It's been a vast asset to my career in the bass voice and so on. But again, these things become self-reinforcing. Once I'd started to play historical figures, and then the first time I played other than an American, there are many very fine American actors who go through their whole careers never playing other than a 20th century part and never playing other than an American, which is marvelous, but it left a great deal of opportunity open for me. And I think once I played the first or second, I've forgotten which was the first one, I suppose Moses, and then El Cid, and then Khartoum, and Henry VIII.
Well, Andrew Jackson.
Andrew Jackson, but I'm speaking of foreign roles.
I see, yes.
Where I was playing other mm-hmm. than an American. And always in a film with international release, they want to have American actors in principal roles. And I seemed to suddenly become the main guy for that, which suited me very well. They're interesting men to play, all of them. And they do form a large part of my career.
In your investigation, was there any one quality more than any other that all these great men had in common? Is there one thing great men have?
Yes, I believe strongly in great men. They have indeed shaped the world. And I think an interesting quality they almost all share, they have rather meager private lives. The single exception would be Andrew Jackson, who was passionately in love with his wife till she died just a few days before he was inaugurated as president. But almost all the rest of them are so busy saving the world, driving the Moors out of Spain, painting the Sistine ceiling, that their capacity to achieve things other men can't do fills their nature. That's who they are. Brigham Young, John the Baptist, Moses. None of those people had very nice lives. And Henry VIII, Mark Antony, they all end in bloody, in death. Bloody deaths, usually. Gordon of Khartoum. Almost all the guys I played came to sorry ends, but they were great men, and they spent their lives achieving what drove them.
Now, research plays a big part in your investigating these men before you play.
Oh,
what
sure.
about clothes? I mean, do you feel differently when you're Charlton Heston sitting here in a suit and tie as you would if you have on toga or something like that?
And many actors, again, not many actors play at parts where you require a different wardrobe or living in a different time. At least not British. The Brits do, of course. They play all sorts of parts, but not American actors. And when they do put themselves in another century, in another period, another country perhaps, you can see they're sort of uncomfortable with the wardrobe. You have to learn to wear chain mail. You have to learn, you walk differently in chaps and cowboy boots with a gun in your hip than you do in modern clothes. And the most actors deal with that by taking as much of the wardrobe off between shots as you can, That's not a good idea. You want to learn to limit it. It's not costume. It's not wardrobe. It's clothes. It's the clothes you wear.
Mm-hmm.
It's hilarious to watch, often quite, at least for actors, good horsemen, trying to get on a horse in a cloak, because you end up with, as you swing your right foot over the saddle, over the back of the horse, the cloak comes and you end up sitting on the cloak, which is going down over the horse's tail, and you have to pull the cloak out and do it again. What you have to do is drape the cloak over your arm, take the horn of the saddle, and then the cloak is out of the way till you get on, and it drops as it should. And to wear a sword, to use a sword, to know how to do sword play, is these are all learned experiences, of course.
Any great men of history that you wanted to play and didn't?
Yes, the Duke of Wellington. I've always admired him, found him an interesting, thorny, caustic, but very effective man. And unfortunately, you can't do a film on Wellington without the Battle of Waterloo, and they cannot afford to shoot the Battle of Waterloo again, so that I will never play the Duke of Wellington, nor will anyone else.
Is the epic film pretty much dead as we know it?
Yes, because of cost. You couldn't, well, let's take an offhand example, Ben-Hur, which cost $14,700,000 when it was made, then the most expensive film of its time, the most trivial kids' film now would cost more than that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they have a program which can tell you if you want to change something, and if you're going to shoot in Vancouver instead of Los Angeles, what's going to be the difference in the cost, and the computer can give you those answers like that. Someone found the line item budget on Ben-Hur. That means line item means every dollar spent for everything, the water, the transportation, whatnot. And they ran it through this computer program saying, what would it cost to make Ben-Hur today? They said $238 million. Wow. That's true of Lawrence of Arabia or El Cid or Spartacus or any of those films. They simply are too big physically to shoot.
Interesting. We talked about you doing Ten Commandments after having worked with DeMille on mm-hmm. Greatest Show on Earth. You worked with William Wyler on The Big Country, and then Ben-Hur.
Then Ben-Hur, of course.
Do you think Ben-Hur would have happened if it hadn't been for The Big Country?
It's hard to say. Obviously, working for him in Big Country made a big difference to him. It gave him certain confidence that I, in Spencer Tracy's immortal dictum, showed up on time, knew my words, and didn't bump into things. And I guess he liked the performance well enough to cast me in what was the film of his life, and you could argue mine too.
Back to Big Country for one moment. Mm-hmm. That was a great film.
It is a fine film.
And you had been playing these great leads. That is, in essence, the supporting part. Why did you take that part?
To work for Wyler.
Really?
Yeah. At the time, it was submitted to me, and I was beginning to think I was pretty hot stuff, you know, and getting an awful lot of offers. And I said, you know, this is about the fifth part, I said to my agent. And I said, I think I'll pass on this. And he said, you are out of your mind, Chuck. You have an offer from the best director, the most in-demand director in the movies, in a good part, with a great cast. And he said, you are going to do this part. And I said, okay, I'll do the part. And of course, he was quite right.
Good agent.
And, you know, we had Jeannie Simmons and
Burl Ives,
who won the Academy Award, Charlie Pickford. It was an extraordinary cast. And Chuck Connors as the heavy of heavies. And I was playing sort of a heavy. And it was a very good experience. William Wyler, I wouldn't go so far as to say he was the greatest director in film. He was the greatest director of performance in film, I'll tell you that.
And why? What did he do that was so different?
I don't know, but as a statistic, actors working in his films earn something like more than 40 Academy nominations and about 13 Oscars for Best Actor. And no other director comes close to that record. He was very demanding. He was not chummy with the actors. Very nice guy off the set, but very focused on the set. He didn't give you firm instructions, really. He just said, do it again. He says, that's no good. And you'd say, well, you told me to do it faster, or whatever it was he told you. He says, yeah, I was wrong. Don't forget that. That's no good. Do something else. I remember that in Ben-Hur, there was a moment where I come back to the empty house of Hur after I've been released from the slave galley, and the house is empty and dark. And I walk down a flight of steps, and that's all there was to it, no dialogue. How can you miss that? He did about 7 takes, and he said, no, do it again, another take. Finally, I said, Willie, you got to help me here. I don't know how else to do this. I'm just coming in and walking down the steps. He said, I know. He said, but in the very first take, when the camera missed the dolly missed, he said, your foot kicked that broken pot, and it made an interesting sound. He said, I was hoping that would happen again. I said, Willie, I tried that to see if it was work. I did that on purpose. I said, if you want the pot to go down the steps, trust me, that's what you pay me for. But he just wanted to see if it would happen. And he depended on that a lot. He was not easy to work for. I don't mean a shouter, but mm-hmm. very tough, very demanding. And as I've said more than once, working for Willie was like getting the works in a turkey's bath. You damn near drown, but you come out smelling like a rose.
Well, knowing that, and knowing that Ben-Hur was such a big project, and you were going to be on it for so long in Italy, did you ever have any qualms about doing it? I mean, it's a great part, of course, but did you ever think, wow, I'm not sure I want to do that with him for a year?
No. I have always been confident that I could do whatever part I was assigned, Macbeth or whatever, which I had a moment of comeuppance there very early in the shoot when we were shooting the first scene between Missala and Ben-Hur at almost the beginning of the film. And Willie came into my dressing room one night and he said, Chuck, you got to be better in this part. And I said, okay, what can I do? He said, I don't know. He said, I wish I did. He said, if I knew, I'd tell you and you'd do it and that would be fine, but I don't know. All I know is you gotta be better, and I thought I should tell you that. That
wow.
was very tough. I spent a long time with a glass of scotch in my hand after that, but I must have been better.
Isn't that interesting?
No, he was, as I said, tough man.
Yeah. It's hard for people, I think, to conceive today what was at stake when Ben-Hur was made.
And the whole studio was at stake.
All of MGM.
All of MGM would have today and long ago been a shopping mall if that picture
Because
had
they really done. Didn't have a lot of resources then, and they put it all into this one.
They put everything they had into that.
So it was a big gamble.
Then they lost a lot of it with Mutiny and the Bounty. But
yeah.
that was then. By then they were back
did
in their
feet. Did that add a pressure to all of you when you were making the film, knowing that so much was riding on it?
Well, I didn't feel that, and I don't think Willie did. I think Willie, too, was perfectly confident that he could make a great picture. I think Willie did every kind of film, comedies, detective stories, westerns, everything, social dramas, but he had never done an epic. And I think that's what drew him to it, because he knew it would be a formidable, just a bitch of a job. But he knew he could do it, and he wanted to prove it, I think.
And it's interesting that he made probably the greatest single biblical epic anyone ever did.
Well, he made one of the most successful films ever made, and certainly the most honored film. And,
yes, 12 Academy Award nominations, 11 Oscars, no
11
other films
Oscars, yeah, they won't,
match
they
that.
Won't match that again.
No.
But, and he was, he deserved, and he got an Oscar, you know, one of the Oscars, and it was, he deserved it.
Did you talk to any of the other Wyler veterans that had worked on long projects with him before doing that film?
No, I'd worked with him
once.
In Big Country, and so I had no uncertainties about work. I can please directors. At least I can stay out of trouble with them.
The Chariot Race, one of the incredible sequences of all time.
It was fixed, you know.
You were going to win regardless?
Yeah, there it is.
Never a question.
You're hearing this for the first time.
But that has to be really incredible. I mean, you guys were all out there with not only having to hit marks and all of that, but with horses and with...
I spent 5 weeks learning to drive the chariot beforehand. And I remember Yakima Kanat, who directed the race, taught me personally every day 2-3 hours for several weeks. And we were resting the horses one day, and we were resting me, really, and I was sitting in the sand sweating, and I said, you know, Willie, I can drive, or not Willie, you know, Yak, I can drive this chariot now, I know I can, thanks to you, but I'm a little worried. It's only been this one chariot, one team, and you and me out here all these weeks. We're going to start shooting this, and there's going to be 7 other teams. I don't know if I can cut that. Yak looked at me, and he said, Chuck, you just make sure you stay in the chariot. I guarantee you're going to win the damn race. I've always treasured that
story. That's wonderful.
I did, too. I won.
I remember.
Yeah.
Now, that great flip scene, how did that happen?
That was an accident.
It was?
Yes. His son, Yak's son, Joe, who doubled me for that, and had doubled me and directed second units for me for both our careers, was supposed to be chained in there, because his dad told him, he said, you know, when you go over that wreck, it's going to flip in the air. No way in the world you can stay in that chariot. But Joe, carrying the burden of being the son of the greatest stuntman who ever lived, the man who invented stunting as a profession, just unhooked the chain. I have no idea why, and I've never dared to ask him. But he was the greatest natural athlete I've ever seen, and when the chariot did indeed flip like that, going over the wreck, and Joe did a handstand on the rails at the front, turned and dropped to the single tree, and threw himself clear of the chariot, which weighed half a ton with steel wheels. It would have killed him. And when Willie saw the footage, the daily footage, I said, my God, we've got to have that in the movie. And Yak said, you know, Willie, I thought Ben-Hur was supposed to win this race. He said, I don't believe Chuck can catch that team on foot. And he said, no, we'll put him on the single tree and he can climb in, which I did very quickly.
That's incredible. How do you choose, because this must have come up many times in your career, what stunts you will do and what you won't do?
You do the ones that the stunt coordinator or the second unit director tells you you are able to do. And you do your best, you know, if it's sword fights or jousting scenes or whatever it is, climbing scenes. I don't like climbing scenes. I don't mind fire, animals, horses, fights, things like that. But the guy, I don't depend on the director for that. If I say to the stunt coordinator or second unit director, who's the man that knows that, say, can I do this shot? And if he says, yeah, then I do it.
Any close calls?
Not really. I had a horse fall on me, one of Sam Peckinpah's horses in Major Dundee, and caught my foot under. But at the time, it was nothing. 30 years later, it ended up in a hip operation, but that's fine now, too, and tennis again and all that. But that's the worst I ever had.
Do you have a favorite scene in Ben-Hur as an actor?
I think either watching the crucifixion of Christ or the confrontation with Messala when I'm sent to the slave galleys. Those are good scenes.
Let's have a little look at Ben-Hur, as a matter of fact, right now.
Good. Oh, yes. Where I'm escaping, about to escape. Very rough treatment, those fellows.
Not one of your good days here.
No. Aha. One, there's two, jumping, breaking the staff, and I'm free.
Stephen Boyd?
That's not Stephen Boyd,
wasn't
that's
he
me.
After you?
He's waiting inside in his office. I want to find him. Interesting thing about this scene, you know. When I was a little boy, there we are, see?
little boy?
I suffered from a recurrent nightmare about, maybe once a year, not oftener than that. I would have it. It was always the same. I would be climbing up a circular stone staircase in a castle, of course, and to rescue a princess. And when I got to the top and opened the door, a witch would spring out screaming and cackling, and I would turn and run down the stairs and jump off into the void, which ends all nightmares, of course. And it was not a huge thing, but I've had it almost at least once a year. And when we were shooting this scene, I was very nervous and very edgy, and I was sweating while they were setting up the shot where I jump off the staircase. And I thought, I didn't know what to make of it. And Willie said, "Chuck," he said, "you'd look kind of lousy." He said, "Are you okay?" I said, I'm fine, let's do the shot." And he says, "You know, they got a blanket down there for you to fall on." I said, "It's no kind of a jump. It's just, let's do the damn shot." And we did, and nothing happened. And I suddenly realized at that moment that it was the landscape of my dream, of my nightmare. And I've never had that nightmare since.
Really?
Isn't that curious?
Yes.
Strange how the human psyche works. Still a good scene.
Now, you did a lot of publicity for Ben-Hur, and you've had to do that for a lot of
every
your films.
Every picture. It's part of the job.
Do you feel that is part of the job of an actor?
Actors who don't do publicity are either idiots or fools, because it's part of what they pay you for, and the actor's the only one that can do it. You can't send the writer out. Just some directors can do them. DeMille could do interviews. Wyler could do pretty good interviews, but most directors it's not what they do.
And the media doesn't really want to talk to them as much as
well,
to the stars.
Well, famous directors, they will. Spielberg, a DeMille, of course, a Wyler. But other than that, it's really the actor's job. That's what actors do for a living anyway.
Have you ever had to go out and sell a film you weren't that keen about?
Sure.
And how do you work around that?
Your best. Do your best. You still, if the film, we all have made films that feel a little uncertain about, but it's part of what they pay you the money for, to go out and do your best to sell it. The actor is the contact with the audience, and doing the tours and doing the interviews and public appearances are the only times they ever see you in real life.
Now, the film got 11 Academy Awards. Mm-hmm. When Academy Award night rolled around, there were 12 nominations. You were up for Best Actor. It was the picture everybody was talking about, the picture of the year. You must have had some kind of inkling that you might walk home with the statue.
Well, the part I treasure, the memory I treasure, was that I happened to enter the theater at the same time as Jimmy Stewart, who was nominated as well. And nothing would do but what we had to be photographed shaking each other's hands and saying good luck and so on. And then we were going in, and Jimmy stopped. He took my arm. He said, "Chuck, I hope you win. I really mean that."
Yeah.
Still chokes me up. No other actor alive would say that, let alone mean it. Jimmy meant it.
Any other memories of that night? It must have been a big blur.
Well, I remember sitting beside my wife, Lydia, and Susan Hayward opened the envelope. And of course, it's a tense moment. But I happened to glance just up to the side of the theater. No, there was nothing there, some chandelier or something. And I thought, I won. And I sat perfectly calmly, and I did. Very eerie experience. I was at that second, which was about 15 seconds before she read it, I knew I had won. Very strange.
It's yeah. Him talking again.
Yeah, I guess.
Just in Oscars in general, do you have a favorite Oscar moment that doesn't have anything to do with you?
Well, you have to remember that all these are subjective judgments.
Right.
Nobody seriously thinks that the Academy Award means you did the best performance or wrote the best script or the best score, or did the best direction or camera work. It means that the people who do the work you do liked what you did. That's why it's the most important of all the awards, more than the Cannes Festival, the Berlin Festival, all those other things we pick up from time to time. It represents the judgment of your peers, and we all want that more than anything.
One of my favorite Oscar moments is the night that I believe your car broke down on the way to the Oscars.
Oh, yes, I was presenting then. I forget who I was presenting, but my flat tire. And Clint Eastwood was hustled on to do and I just got there as he was about to open his mouth and stepped on and said, "Thanks, Clint." And he said, "God, I'm glad you're here." He's a good guy.
Now I want to go from Oscars to Orson, the big O's, Orson Welles, and worked with him in a film, Touch of Evil.
Touch of Evil.
And tell us about Orson Welles, certainly one of the giants that we're all interested
indeed.
In
indeed. Sir, I would begin by saying that I agree with Cahiers du Cinéma's definition of Touch of Evil. They said, Touch of Evil is not a great film. It is unquestionably the best B-movie ever made, and I think that's inaccurate. It's not Citizen Kane, but it is a inevitably fascinating movie to watch. Orson, in my opinion, was the most talented man I've ever met, which doesn't mean I think he was the best director or the best actor or the best writer, because I don't. And I don't know how you define talent anyway, but however you define it, he had it. I think, in a sense, he was a self-destructive man, too. He was wonderful to work for, very exciting, writing a script. I think my best contribution to movies in the end may be that I was responsible for Orson Welles making the last film he made in America when he hadn't worked here for 10 years. And they'd offered me this film script, and I read it. I was up hunting in Michigan at the time. And the studio called me, and they said, "What do you think?" I said, "Well, it's a police story." I said, "It's okay, but so many have been made, it depends on who's directing it, who's going to direct it." And the guy said, "Well, we don't have a director yet, but Orson Welles is going to play the heavy." And I said, "Why don't you have him direct it? He's a pretty good director." There was a dead silence. You'd thought I'd ask that my mother direct the film. But they said, "Oh, yeah, Citizen Kane and like that. Well, we'll take that into consideration." Probably thought, what a stupid idea. Well, Heston will just get sore if we don't. How bad can it be? And he did what is a very memorable film in on schedule, I think $20,000 over budget, something like that. And however, after he finished his first cut, he went off to Mexico. Now, you can't do that to a studio. It's their money. And they never forgave him for that. They didn't let him finish the second cut. And he never had another job in Hollywood, which is too bad. There was some self-destructive
did
thing.
You ever think you've got a key as to what that was?
No idea. We talked of other films, but nothing ever came of them. He was a fascinating guy to work for. I'm very grateful for the chance.
The incredible opening shot that we know about.
Still the best Chapman boom shot in the history of the movies.
It's incredible. And was that done basically because he was trying to prove that he could indeed?
Well, it was a remarkable shot.
Yes.
And it was a marvelous way to shoot the sequence, the shot. And it lasted, I think, about 5-6 minutes.
But legend has it he did that to prove that he could be ahead of schedule and get a couple days work done.
Oh no, he proved that the first day of shooting, when he had an 11-page scene scheduled for several days of work, and he didn't turn a camera till 2 p.m. And there was all kinds of stuff with doors pulling out, and there were about 5 different people with speaking parts in the scene and so on, and he finally began to turn, and uneasy knots of executives were standing in the corner talking among themselves. They didn't dare approach him. And he finally did about 6 takes in the shot. And then he said, "Okay, print, that's a wrap. We're 2 days ahead of schedule." And they always thought he would do that again. But the Chapman boom shot needed all the time it got, and it is a now, of course, you have Python booms, and they can be controlled from the ground. You can do that kind of shot easily. You couldn't do it then.
Did you ever come close to working together again?
Yes, often. In a film, I later did the film for Rank of Julius Caesar. Mm-hmm. But he had one plan for CBS, and different people were going to be in it, and different people were going to shoot in different places. But it never, again, he was not trusted as a director because of the
The way back to Citizen Kane as well, right?
Yeah. Although Citizen Kane has been voted three times, I think, the greatest film ever made, and probably is. But he was a charismatic figure. He was so good at it, it bored him, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And he would lose interest after his first cut, I think.